from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The fact that the Kiev government has placed the separatists in the east under siege with the help of neo-Nazis has finally made the Western media. According to the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph, the Azov Battalion, one of a number of militia groups that are openly backed by the Ukrainian Interior Ministry to carry out attacks on the self-proclaimed People's Republics in Donetsk and Lugansk, are using the neo-Nazi Wolf's Angel symbol on their banner, and members of the battalion are openly white supremacists and or anti-Semites. The newspaper interviewed one Azov member who called himself Phantom. The paper reports that he said, quote, "I'm a Nazi," closed quote. The siege of Donetsk intensified over the weekend as forces loyal to the Kiev government attempted to seal off the eastern stronghold of pro-independence forces. We begin with this report from Press TV.
Fighting rages on in the Ukrainian city of Donetsk as government forces close in on the eastern stronghold of pro-Russian militias. Now, Kiev says it will stop the march only if pro-Russia forces surrender. But the pro-Russians say talks on a possible ceasefire could only begin if the Ukrainian army withdraws from the region. Donetsk was the scene of loud explosions throughout Sunday. At least one person was killed and 10 others were injured in the shelling there. More than 10 residential buildings and a hospital were also heavily damaged. Ukrainian officials say 100,000 people have left Donetsk in the past week alone. They say thousands of residents have no access to gas, electricity and phone service, adding that the region is under the threat of a humanitarian crisis. Joining us via Skype is our correspondent Lena Savchuk from Kiev. Now, Lena, as we just mentioned, it's a humanitarian crisis in the making in Donetsk. A lack of food, fuel, basic supplies. We've seen medical personnel and centers being targeted as well. Now, tell us a bit more about the humanitarian condition over there and what's being done to resolve it.
Well, according to rebel leader Zakharchenko, food supplies and water is running out in the city. But actually, the situation is much worse in the second biggest stronghold of pro-Russians, which is the city of Lugansk. People over there have been without any reliable sources of food for almost 7 days. And we know that fighting is going on around on the outskirts of Lugansk, and people are cut from any electricity and gas and water.
Patrick Lancaster has been in the eastern part of Ukraine for the past 4 months. He filed this update on the situation in Donetsk Saturday.
This morning, the morning of Saturday, August 9th, I received a call from a local contact that I have made that his streets had been hit with artillery fire shortly before he called. And I immediately headed that way, and in the area that he was referring to, I met him there, and he gave me a little tour around his street and the surrounding neighborhood that was also hit. I witnessed five different apartment complexes that had extensive damage. Two of the apartment buildings were hit with direct hits. There was about a four-car garage that was completely burnt to the ground with cars inside. It appeared that it had taken a direct hit as well. And there were many civilians walking around, some cleaning up the area. And it was very surreal because in the middle of four of the apartment complexes that were hit, there was a children's playground. And I'm not sure about the casualties. There wasn't any directly reported to us at the time, but it had just happened. While we were there, there was many people eager to talk to us about why is the Ukraine government doing this to the people, and why are they bombing the people. And then in this crowd of people that were wanting to talk to us about why is Ukraine doing this, two women showed up that were very vocal in saying that in their opinion it was the Donetsk People's Republic military that did it. And at that point much commotion started, and the people started arguing with the two people that were there, and at a couple points it got a little bit physical. No one was hurt, there was just a couple women pushing each other back and forth, but it really shows how complicated this war is, and no one really knows for sure exactly what's happening.
On Sunday, Lancaster reported that by far the heaviest shelling of the city was heard from the Donetsk city center. In an update Monday, he reported that explosions in and around the city were, in his words, almost constant. However, there were reports Monday that Russian President Vladimir Putin had informed the head of the European Commission, Jose Manuel Barroso, that Russia is sending a humanitarian convoy to Ukraine together with the International Red Cross Committee. Meanwhile, independence forces in East Ukraine have been receiving volunteers from around the world, including two Spanish volunteers who joined the fight against Kiev's offensive. Speaking out against the actions of the Ukrainian military and right sector militias, the two said their main objective is to spread the truth about the conflict.
What we see in these weeks that we are here is only bombing population, assault of all the fronts from Kyiv. They are trying to separate the cities. They are sending mercenaries to kill the journalists and to atemorize any person that can tell the truth about what's happening here.
Angel Davila Rivas, 29 years old, and Rafa Munez, 28, arrived in Donetsk 2 weeks ago to offer their assistance to the residents of East Ukraine. Davila Rivas noted that Russia has no presence in the area and could do more in terms of humanitarian aid.
La casa de los sindicatos. Me enteré de que murió un chaval. I never see a Russian soldier like, bueno, volunteers like us, but yes. Not really Russia is doing anything, and I think that Russia should do more for these people, not with guns, but just with helping people, medicians.
Esto se intenta subsanar a través de redes sociales. Yo llevo bastantes.
More people can have to come here. If they don't want not to take the guns, but all people can help in something in the kitchen, cleaning, telling the truth to these countries from here and watching the situation by their own eyes. It's most important that a lot of people more come here to help in what they can. Not, it's necessary only soldier.
The pair has not engaged in the fighting just yet, stressing that their main goal is to reveal the truth about what's happening on the ground. Both arrived by train to eastern Ukraine from Madrid and joined the Vostok Battalion of the Self-Defense Forces. Meanwhile, the Donetsk region militia said it is ready for a ceasefire to stop the humanitarian catastrophe. That statement came after a session Friday at the UN Security Council, where UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon voiced serious concerns over the situation in East Ukraine. In the midst of another U.S. intervention and fighting with ISIL forces, Iraq may have a new prime minister. We have this report from Press TV's Kovi Tavwe.
Iraq's new president Fuad Masum has asked Haider al-Abadi to form the next government. Haider al-Abadi is the nominee for prime minister picked by Iraq's bloc of Shia parties, the National Alliance. Shortly after designated as premier, al-Abadi said that all Iraqis must cooperate against, quote, barbaric campaign by the ISIL terrorists. Under Iraq's constitution, al-Abadi will now have 30 days to bring a cabinet to parliament for approval. A senior U.S. diplomat with responsibility for Iraq has congratulated al-Abadi on being appointed to former governments. The incumbent Maliki, however, said that he will not give in to pressure to drop his bid for a third term.
U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf was grilled about the announcement and the possibility of whether a coup may be underway in the midst of the military activity around the country.
What do you consider Prime Minister Maliki now? You say he's still
the Prime Minister, legally under the Iraqi constitution.
But do you consider him a lame duck? Do you consider him on his way out? Do you consider him still a person you would work with?
Well, certainly we will continue working and engaging with him, given that he's still the Prime Minister of Iraq. Absolutely. And Iraq is facing a very dire situation right now. But we've said that in order for Iraq to better confront ISIL going forward, they need an inclusive government in place as soon as possible. There's a process for that government to be in place, and what you saw today was just another step in that process.
Would you say he has a mandate democratically to still make decisions?
Prime Minister Maliki, he's still the Prime Minister, legally under the Constitution.
Marie,
Saeed, then we'll go around.
Marie, what is happening now? You probably addressed this before I came. I'm sorry, I was late. Now that he's deploying tanks and security forces and so on, you don't think that's, in a way, some sort of a coup?
Well, how can it be a coup if he's still the Prime Minister? Well, that seems a strange word to use.
He's deploying.
But he's still the Prime Minister.
He's still the Prime Minister, but he's deploying.
So by definition, coup would not be it.
Well, yeah, but
he's
using these forces to consolidate his power and sort of disfranchise others.
I think that's making a number of assumptions about Prime Minister Maliki's intentions. I don't want to speak for him. I would note, A, that there's a huge security threat right now from ISIL, even in Baghdad. So, A. But B, look, there's a process in place here. Prime Minister Maliki's party, which is part of this bloc, nominated someone new to be prime minister.
Right.
And it's the Iraqi people speaking up and choosing their own future. So let's, you know, we're watching the situation on the ground, but there's been no, in our view, discernible change in the security picture in terms of the kind of resources you're talking about him deploying.
Okay, so are you supporting Haider al-Abadi as a prime minister? Well, is he someone that is known to you?
Vice President Biden spoke with him today,
right.
Congratulated him on his nomination, and called on him for very quickly, as soon as possible, to form a new government and develop a national program. The prime minister-designate expressed his intent to move expeditiously to do so. And the vice president and he had a conversation today. Obviously, we support the process. We have never supported any one person or one party here.
Okay, but you know the fact that the vice president spoke to him, that's like a ringing endorsement, isn't it?
Well, it's not about who we speak to on the phone. It's about who the Iraqis choose through their process, which they've done today, to be their next prime minister. That's how this gets chosen here. Yeah, Arshad, go ahead, and then Michelle.
It's real simple. Did the U.S. government at any level play any role whatsoever in the selection of Prime Minister designate al-Abadi to his current position?
No, this is a decision that has a constitutional process in Iraq, and that is the process that happened here. Yes.
But Prime Minister Maliki has rejected the nomination of Mr. al-Abadi as a prime minister. And
I haven't actually seen him make public comments today.
Some members of his bloc
made
the comments.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, well, he hasn't, to my knowledge, made comments today. And again, I'm sure people have a variety of opinions, but the way their constitutional process works is the bloc puts forward a candidate, which they did. This bloc, by the way, includes Prime Minister Maliki's party, a number of whose members voted for the new prime minister designate in this process. So this is how it works. Some people may not agree with it, but it's how the process works constitutionally. That's what we think is important.
And do you expect this rejection will affect the process of the formation of the new government?
No, we think the process should move forward as it's laid out in the Constitution, as it has until this point. Look, we never expected this would be easy or without bumps in the road here. We know this is complicated, and we know there are a lot of tensions here among certain blocs, certain people, certain parties, certain groups. So we didn't think it would be easy, but it's proceeding actually along the path that the Constitution sets forward.
There was a major protest today in Baghdad. Thousands of people were reportedly attending the protest, objecting the nomination of al-Abadi. They were supporting Prime Minister Maliki. I'd like to ask you a broader question on whether, how democratic do you think that this is? While many people know that people voted for Maliki's coalition mainly because of Maliki.
Well, that's
because
that's the way coalition politics works in this kind of parliamentary system.
Mm.
In the constitutional system the Iraqis have laid out, you vote for a bloc and the bloc chooses their their prime minister candidate based on their internal voting. So that's the way the process works. There's a reason it's outlined in the Constitution, and they've stuck to that process. So again, there's still some steps that need to go, but we've seen progress today with the new prime minister designate.
So I just want to understand, you do support President Masum, and he has that authority according to the Constitution.
That is true, as the guarantor of the Constitution.
Right. Mm-hmm. To name the prime minister.
Correct.
So you support this process.
We
and
support
you don't
the
agree,
process.
You don't, you, I mean, the you know, he picked a candidate for the premiership, correct?
That was put forward by the Shia bloc.
That was put forward. So mm-hmm. when Maliki claims that there was a miscarriage of constitutional authority, you disagree with that notion?
We absolutely disagree with that.
When asked if reports that the U.S. was directly providing arms to the Peshmerga, the Kurds fighting ISIL in the north, Harf admitted it, but was repeatedly evasive about whether or not it was being done with the explicit permission of the Iraqi government.
The United States decided to directly arm the Peshmerga. How does that work in terms of arming the central army or the central
Well, I think
forces?
There's been a little bit of sort of, I should say, breathless reporting on this, so let's just talk through this a little bit. The government of Iraq has made deliveries from its own stocks to the Kurds, and we are working to do the same in coordination with all the relevant parties. We said this last week. I said it from the podium. Mm-hmm. I think Ben Rhodes and others said it on TV. ISIL's obtained some heavy weaponry. The Kurds need additional arms. We are providing those and working to provide additional. Obviously, we're all of this is done in coordination with the central government of Iraq. And look, I think another key point here, Saeed, is that we've seen a really unprecedented level of cooperation between the Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga and the Kurds that we really hadn't seen before, including the ISF providing, I think, air support and ammo to the Kurds. So it's really a team effort here. We're all helping out. We're seeing what more ways we could expedite their requests.
Would you still have the Peshmerga if Baghdad refused to cooperate, to agree to that?
I'm not gonna venture to guess on hypotheticals here.
Question: did you get the explicit consent of the Iraqi government in Baghdad for you to provide arms directly to the Peshmerga?
Everything we're doing, we're working very closely with the central government in Iraq.
But
yes.
Yes is the answer.
Arshad,
you did get there.
Everything we are doing is in close coordination with the Iraqi government.
Can we clarify that?
Right.
Yes. Can you just clarify that? I mean, did you just say that the U.S. is directly arming the Peshmerga or the Kurdish forces with the consent of the government in Baghdad?
I said what I said. I can repeat it again. We are working with the government of Iraq to accelerate deliveries of badly needed arms to Kurdish forces in the north. The GOI has made deliveries from its own stocks, and we are working to do the same. Deliveries from our own stocks in coordination with all the relevant parties.
But your own
stocks. So that conversation is ongoing. We're not going to detail every single way we provide support, as we don't many places. But in general, we are working together to provide the Kurds with arms.
Okay.
This isn't anything new. We talked about this last week.
The Kurdish government is saying that it's directly receiving arms.
And I just said we are actively working to do that. But just because we can talk directly to the Kurds or work directly with them doesn't mean it's all not in coordination with the government of Iraq.
But there's a difference between, you know, asking or letting the government in Baghdad know that this is happening and actually funneling the arms and the ammo through the government in Baghdad and letting them do the delivery. So
we're not going to detail specifically how all of this takes place. We're just not going to do that from the podium. We are having ongoing conversations with all of the parties about how we can all get arms to the Kurds as quickly as possible.
Who's supplying?
But do you have the Iraqi government's consent for you to directly arm the Kurds?
As I said, we are working with the government of Iraq very closely on all. I'm not going to detail everything for you.
You can't say whether you have their consent, which I find very odd, given that you're...
I find it's an odd question that you keep asking. When I said I'm not going to detail all the specifics here, but we are working very closely with them, and we are all doing this in coordination with each other.
This is not a highly specific question, and it's a relevant question because your guidance, including from the podium up until, I think, last Wednesday, was that you don't do any arming of the Kurds without doing it with the consent of
I would
the
go
Iraqi
back
government.
And look at what I said from the podium over the past few weeks, Arshad, before you make those generalizations. As I said, this is being done in full coordination and cooperation with the Iraqi government.
Another 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza has provided some relief to the besieged residents of what many call the world's largest prison camp. Derek Mbatha reports.
A new three-day humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, announced by Israelis and Palestinians, has been welcomed by the United Nations Secretary General. Israelis and Palestinians, meeting in the Egyptian capital Cairo, announced on Sunday that they had accepted the unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. In a statement issued by his spokesperson, the Secretary General expresses his strong hope that this will give the two sides, under Egyptian auspices, another chance to agree on a durable ceasefire. Secretary General Ban says this will benefit all civilian populations, and he also hopes that it can be a starting point to address the underlying grievances on both sides. Mr. Ban continues to urge all concerned to work constructively to this end and to avoid any steps which would lead to a return to violence, the statement adds. When the first humanitarian ceasefire expired on Friday, the death toll of Palestinians was reported to be over 1,900, of whom more than 1,400 are believed to be civilians. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Meanwhile, the UN has announced that it's impaneled a group of experts to conduct an investigation of war crimes in Gaza. Patrick Maigwa reports from the United Nations.
The UN Human Rights Council has appointed a three-member international commission of inquiry to investigate violation of international human rights law committed during the latest Israeli military offensive in Gaza. The commission will be chaired by William Shabas, a professor of international law from Canada. Other members are Ms. Amal Alamuddin, a British-Lebanese lawyer, and Dudu Dien from Senegal, who also served as the UN Special Rapporteur on Racism. The formation of the commission was mandated by the Human Rights Council during last month's special session on the situation of human rights in Gaza, following the launch by Israel of its military offensive codenamed Operation Protective Edge on July 8. The commission is expected to identify any violations of international and human rights law committed during the military operations, identify those responsible, and make recommendations on accountability. The United Nations estimates that over 1,900 Palestinians, including 456 children and 237 women, have been killed. Over 425,000 Palestinians are currently sheltering within schools run by the United Nations Agency Assisting Palestinians, UNRWA. The Commission of Inquiry is expected to present its report to the Human Rights Council in March 2015. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations, Geneva.
Over the past week, many thousands around the world gathered to protest Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip, which has resulted in nearly 2,000 deaths, including the deaths of more than 400 children. One such protest took place in New York City, where thousands marched from Columbus Circle to the UN headquarters. We spoke with one protester, Lisa Davis, by telephone during the march.
It's actually been a dynamic day. So many people have come out in support of the Palestinian people. You have children, you have people of all different nationalities. Of course, we want to really build this, but I think it's been a dynamic demonstration so far. I really do. People are marching to the UN. I would say somebody said about 4,000 people. I don't know if it was that large, but it was definitely a large crowd of people. Initially, I wasn't so sure when I first got here, but the crowd just kept piling up and filling the streets. And now everybody's walking to the UN and yelling, "Cancer, free, free Palestine."
Who were some of the speakers?
Cornel West spoke. Glenn Ford did. You had quite a few speakers. You had this young 14-year-old kid who spoke and talked about how his family was in Gaza and some of them that he was never going to see again. That was very powerful.
Wow.
But it was interesting that at the point when Cornel West was speaking, because, you know, the police were trying this maneuver with just corralling everybody into these, small barricaded area. And so some of us were standing on the outside of the barricades because it's very crowded, very congested, very hot, you know. Mm. That's not a safe situation. You know, it was like very, very packed. You almost felt like sardines. They were, inspecting people to stand inside of that area.
Wow.
And I thought that was just really unnecessary. In fact, I met a comrade from Philadelphia, and the first thing he noticed was the barricades. That needs to be challenged. I think that is really unhealthy. It's very unsafe to just crowd people into a very confined space. And then the natural thing is to want to, you know, step out of that space to, you know, broaden it somewhat, to step beyond the barricades, and then you got police yelling at you.
Let's see. So the turnout was good.
Yes, it was excellent.
Good speakers and now a good crowd going down to the United Nations.
Yes. Okay. And I think I was just so touched by the sentiment of the people, you know, just everyday people. It seemed like most of the crowd, from what I could tell, was just everyday people who were so tired of this, so tired of the killing, so tired of the war. You know, so tired of the way the Palestinian people are being treated, which is just indicative of the way oppressed people have been treated all throughout history, and especially now that the United States is at the height of its imperialist designs. People are just fed up with war.
You know, what kind of response are you getting from as you're marching, from people, you know, the people that are not part of the demonstration, just the everyday, you know, walkabouts in the city?
Well, that's interesting, because as you're mentioning that and I'm looking at people are standing on the sidewalk taking pictures. In fact, there was a sizable crowd of people who were standing opposite the side of the street that the demonstration was on. And for the most part, they seemed like they were really interested, at least if nothing else. Yeah. And they were taking pictures. Every now and then you had maybe one person yell something sarcastic, but very rarely. And then there was somebody even a van at some point with a flag with, you know, a Palestinian flag, and they honked their horn. But I would say for the most part, the people have been receptive.
Wow.
Like I said, I think now perhaps as never before, the message of the Palestinian people are really getting out there. And I think that people are really starting to see the inhumanity in what's going on.
Yep.
You know, it's much more difficult for people now to have an attitude that they just don't care.
Right.
That's
yeah.
becoming increasingly difficult. And that's one of the things that I have sensed. You know, I have sensed now that there's just far more people willing to say, I don't care what anybody thinks. I don't care what. You know, I've seen a lot of Jewish organizations. And, you know, there was one organization, I forget the exact name, but I could see part of the sign that had rabbis and that Israel is wrong. I just think you have just a broader spectrum of people who are just saying that this is wrong, you know, and that's the feeling. Like I said, people are taking pictures, you know, and standing around and watching, and that's kind of, to me, a little encouraging, because when they tend to be against, or when they tend to find the message offensive, I think that they tend to, like, walk away from it or something.
Yeah, they do. You don't usually get people that are, you know, taking even tourist pictures if they have a problem with what's happening.
Exactly. But they are standing around and they're watching and they are taking their pictures.
Mm.
And the signs are bold. Mm. And people are just bravely walking and feeling empowered.
Well, read some of the signs. What do the signs say?
Stop U.S. Israeli massacre in Gaza. I'm walking, I'm like looking at the back of people.
Yeah.
Israel equals racism and genocide. Mm. Another one, free Palestine from the river to the sea.
Mm.
Another one says, no to bomb the deportation. U.S., Israel, hands off of our children. Stop the violence. Are stolen. Israel has built ISO Jewish-only cities inside of Palestine. Violence since September 2000. And homelessness, just a lot of very, very, very powerful signs with strong messages. I did not vote for you to support ethnic cleansing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's directed
That's
to our president.
Banner.
That's right.
Well, believe you me, you know it's going to be reported on, because the people that were, the police that were standing out there, some of them were uniformed, but others of them had their suits on and, you know, so you just know that they had an interesting mix out there.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.